Well, does your garden need a midsummer pick-me-up? Today on Garden Talk, we'll look at ways you can get your garden looking its best. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. And great to have back Melinda Myers. She's on the line with us, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, over 20 gardening books to her credit. So we're going to focus with her on summer gardens, but we can take all your other gardening questions as well, I guess, as we go along. We always have a lot of fun whenever Melinda joins us. So you can join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Well, it's always fun to talk to you and your listeners, Larry.
Well, you know, my front yard, I think because of the amount of shade, the flowering plants like the daylilies and so forth are a little later coming than my neighbors. So my garden looks great right now, but I see a lot of gardens starting to look a little dull.
Well, and you know, the cool, wet spring we had kind of set us back a few weeks, so you're absolutely right. I think we're a little ahead of the curve, but with this recent hot weather, a few drier days in between all this rain we've had, I think we are going to start seeing some changes. And you made a good observation, Larry, is, you know, different parts of your garden are going to bloom at different times, respond differently based on temperatures, those microclimates, the amount of sunlight they receive. And so I always find there's a couple things that happen in my garden. Some of those plans I made and plantings I made didn't quite turn out the way I thought.
I
call it experimenting to help everybody. You know, I did that on purpose. But fortunately, garden centers these days do sell some nice size quality annuals. So not just leftovers, but annuals they plant and grow to a larger size. So we can pop those into those voids or, you know, those of us that were waiting to see if that perennial was going to make a late comeback after a hard winter and decided it's finally dead, you know, we can pull that out and either replace it with another perennial or maybe just temporarily throw in an annual to get some instant color, fill that void until we decide what goes in there permanently. Summer is a good time to plant. You just have to, when the temperatures rise, make sure you mulch the soil around your plant, make sure they get sufficient water, not too much, because they're going to need a little extra TLC when the temperatures rise. But, you know, there's still time. And then if you were late with your vegetable garden, I don't know about you, but I've talked to so many gardeners that were frustrated by the cool, wet spring. Didn't get things in the ground. I have my peas sitting right here by my computer waiting to go in. I miss spring planting, but I'm going to do a summer planting for a fall harvest when the temperatures are cooler. You know, get your greens in, another planting of lettuce, radishes, and beets, things that have time to grow, mature, and give you time to harvest before our first killing frost. So, you know, I think we had a rougher start this year to the season with the, you know, if you didn't have the right day off, you couldn't get in the garden, and the weeds are doing great.
So yes, they are.
Aren't they? there's no doubt. I feel like that's, you know, weed, plant, weed, some more, plant. So, but there's still time to just add those extra things. And, you know, garden art is always a good way to go, I don't know what I'm going to do here. Throw some garden art in. That's a great temporary space holder. It might be permanent as well. So lots of things. And then hanging baskets. You know, I've seen some really nice hanging baskets at garden centers. Take it out of the pot, dig a hole, put it in the garden, instant flower garden.
There you go. I've got to replace some plants inside my pots. You know, I looked at my pots this morning on our front yard, our front porch, and, you know, I went to work and got rid of about half of the flowers in both pots. And I thought, oh, I know what I'm going to be doing this weekend. I'm going to be looking for some smaller plants that will fit in there.
You know, and one of the things I like to do is plan for that, because it happens to all of us. And, you know, spring we put those pansies in, the weather gets hot, they kind of fade, or, you know, something didn't do as well. But things I know I'm going to have to change out, often I'll put them in a smaller container, set them, and then bury that pot inside my larger container. So when I need to change it out, I already have the hole dug.
Ooh.
So I don't disturb the existing roots, you know, when I'm trying to add that new plant. And it makes it easier for us and easier on the plants that remain.
Very good advice. Pam in Kellogg has a question for you, Melinda. So let's go there. Hi, Pam. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, and my favorite speaker.
Oh, thanks, Pam. Not my aunt or cousin, but thanks.
Well, I know what your answer is going to be, so please
Uh-oh.
Don't give it to me. Your answer is going to be have your soil tested. Last year, I put in tires instead of my garden, and I filled it completely with compost, which I did not intend to do. But my son brought all this compost, so it got filled with compost. Now, last year in this, I'm thinking the nitrogen is way too high because it's mostly plant, except for the kale, which is doing fabulous this year. I've given two bags away every single week. But I need to, I did put some lime in it, but that was just a guess. Do you have any guesses?
If this was compost, it's typically not too high in nitrogen. Compost is broken down. It does provide nutrients, and it provides it over a long period of time, and that's why it's such a great soil amendment. What I'm wondering is you might be a little low on phosphorus, so I'm guessing you've got good leaf growth, but you're not getting the flowers and fruit from some of your vegetables growing there.
Is that what it sounds like, Pam?
Yes. I've always had terrific broccoli, great big heads, and this year it's all leaves and like quarter-sized broccoli, which is, I look forward to that every year. The beets, I picked my first one, and my cucumbers, I picked my first two yesterday. The kale is doing the best. The tomatoes are huge, and they're finally starting to put fruit on, but something's
yeah,
off.
You know, thank you. That helps a lot. Part of the problem is our weather. Those folks that planted at the normal planting time around Memorial Day, plants just sat there for a good month or so because the soil and the air was so cool. And then with tomatoes and peppers, they're very sensitive to night temperatures. If the temperatures are too high, the pollen isn't effective. If they're too low, it's not too effective. And so the fact that you're starting to get flowers and fruit tells me, and that your beets are okay, that tells me you probably have a sufficient nutrients, that I think it's more weather-related. The fact that you're starting to get flowers and fruit, I think you're okay. I think it's just more weather-related that's delaying things harvesting. Yes, a soil test is always a good thing, but I think in the short term, I was originally going to recommend maybe doing like a Milorganite for phosphorus, but it sounds like you're getting the fruits eventually, so I think it's more of an issue with the cooler temperatures, the type of weather we've had, the recent hot weather interfering with pollination. So I think it's more weather-related.
Yeah, I think so too, Pam. Thank you very much for calling. So hang in there. Keep watching
those
plants.
I always say, Larry, and I think you'd probably agree, the cool part about working with gardeners is we're all optimistic and a little crazy because we keep doing this every year, no matter the results.
I put my tomatoes in quite late this year. The fruit doesn't look very big right now, but it doesn't look a lot smaller than my neighbors who put theirs in earlier. So,
Exactly. And one of the things I did, I'm with you, I planted late this year, but I threw some floating row cover over my plants early. To, one, protect them because I'm in a pretty windy site, but also to keep things a little warm earlier. And then, obviously, when the weather started settling down a bit and the nights were warmer, pulled it off. And you're right. I'm a little behind those that started a month before me, but I'm not that bad off considering how late I planted. So it's been an interesting year.
Oh, boy. John in Edgerton, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, John.
Hi, I sent an email with pictures of our tomatoes, and we want to know what kind of pruning we need to have done. We're realizing we didn't prune as we should have earlier, and how much should we prune, and what should we do to
Now,
I've got a lot of little tomatoes, but not anything that's ripening.
John, are the I can't see the photo, unfortunately. Are your plants really tight together, or why are you worried about the pruning? Are the plants growing together?
And are the fruit too small? Is that what you're thinking? The fruit should be larger?
I think they should be more rounded. They're a bit wrinkled. They're the small cherry tomatoes.
So they're supposed to be small, but the skin is kind of wrinkled, or the fruit looks like the inside is not filling out to the size of the skin?
Yeah, it's wrinkled, and there's a real heavy line.
I was like, did you send it to me in my email? And I'm kind of quickly looking through, and you're looking at and I'm looking at Facebook too. So here's a couple things we'll talk about fruit, and hopefully this will help not only you but others listening. So when tomatoes start developing the fruit, the amount of moisture we get influences the potential size of the fruit. If it's a dry period, and so the potential size is a little smaller, then we get lots of rain as it's starting to ripen. That's often why we get cracking. Droughty conditions can result in the opposite. You know, lots of water early, drought, you may get more mealy tomatoes. Any kind of environmental stress can lead to cracking of fruit and those kind of problems. Have you tried one of the tomatoes? Do they taste okay, or they're not ripe yet to tell?
No, they're not ripe at all.
Yeah. I would give it some more time. Again, our weather has been rather challenging, you know, with the early starts delaying a lot of people getting. And there's probably some out there going, I've been picking tomatoes for a month. Good for you. The rest of us are jealous. But I think I don't know that there's anything really you can do. It sounds more environmental. When you look up a lot of those misshapen fruit on cucumbers, it's sometimes nutritional. So making sure your soil, you know, if everything else looks fine, your soil's probably good. Soil tests never hurts, as we told Pam earlier. Mm-hmm. And then we can't control the weather, but mulching tomatoes is great because that keeps the soil more consistently moist to avoid problems with blossom end rot and diseases. If you stake and tower your tomatoes, doing it when you plant not only is easier, but also you don't damage the roots. And if you cultivate around the plants, don't be careful that you don't damage those shallow roots because that influences moisture uptake. That can influence the size and shape of the fruit. So we're going to blame the weather on this one. But check those other things too, John, to make sure that's okay. And if it doesn't seem to correct itself, then I would definitely, at the end of the season, take a soil test. That way you'll be ready to go next spring.
There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rick in Holman will give you a chance. Hi, Rick.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm having the same problem with my raspberry patch, and I've got a lot of Concord grapes, and it seems to be spreading. So we planted 4 or 5 new bur oak trees this year, and the leaves are turning brown and crunchy.
You mean the leaves of the grapes and the raspberries, Rick?
What's that?
The leaves of the grapes and raspberries are turning brown, you're saying, and getting crunchy?
Yes.
Okay.
And also on the trees.
Okay.
And all I see on them are Japanese beetles.
Oh, yes. They love.
I don't know if they can cause it.
So here are a couple things. One, Japanese beetles, and I kind of went, because they've been just enjoying my kiwis greatly, and I need to get out there with my can of soapy water. But as you know, they feed between the veins of the leaves, and they make that lacy appearance, on the leaves. And then sometimes the leaves can turn a bit brown. The other thing that can happen with raspberries is there are a few canker diseases and insects that feed on the canes of the plant, and so that can stop the flow of water and nutrients and result in some some browning of the leaf margin. So you're going to want to take a look at the stems and make sure there's nothing happening there. With the Concord grapes, there are some fungal diseases. You know, the cool, wet weather we had, seeing a fair number of leaf spot diseases. And then the bur oak, there's a couple things that can happen on bur oak. Anthracnose, which is a leaf spot disease, typically we see that on the lower canopy of the tree, and brown blotches on the leaf. There is a bur oak blight that can cause problems too. Yeah. So what I would suggest you do, because it, my description and the picture you get in your head may not be matching the problem. So I would look up raspberry, the UW Extension, and I always have to just go the long way, UW Extension raspberry diseases, and then you'll get to a great publication with descriptions that will give you some of the common diseases and insect problems on raspberries, and that will help you do some diagnosis when you go into the garden. The same with growing grapes in Wisconsin is another excellent UW Extension publication. And then I would just do an internet search. I'm sure I haven't checked lately that Brian Huddleston, our plant pathologist from the diagnostic lab, has something on bur oak blight, but also on anthracnose. I would check both of those. Anthracnose, there's nothing you can do. Rake and get rid of those leaves in the fall. The good news is the plant usually produces enough foliage to counteract the loss of leaves. And if it's in otherwise good health, drier spring next year, then you shouldn't see a problem. And then the bur oak blight is a little more, I don't want to get you upset, so check to see if that's even an issue before you start worrying.
Yeah, the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, if you type all that in, you're going to be able to get to Brian Huddleston and find out some more, Rick. Thank you very much for calling in. Good luck. Melinda Myers, our gardening expert extraordinaire, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer today. Dave Potratz, our engineer. And you, my friend, are listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, gardening expert Melinda Myers. You should go to her website if you haven't done it before, melindamyers.com, and you're going to find a whole bunch of good information about your garden and about your neighbor's garden probably too. So, and if you have a question right now, heck, join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Melinda, we had an email from Kate, lives in the Fox Valley, and her beautiful, tall, purple coneflowers were blown down and broken off at the ground by storms. They're perennials, of course, but they build strength from their leaves. How are these plants likely to fare next year?
News is they've had a lot of time to put a lot of energy into their root system for next year. So the good news is it happened later in the season, especially if these are older established plants, and I'm guessing they are. So, you know, if there's, they'll probably even send up some new growth at the base. You could, you know, don't disturb the roots. Leave them intact. You may want to mark the location if there's nothing there so you don't accidentally disturb the roots. But if this would be something I would bet on, that they'll probably come back for you next year because they've had some good time to grow, plenty of moisture early in the season, lots of heat just recently. So they should be fine for next year. The sad part is you're missing their peak bloom, and I feel your pain. You know, you've waited all season to see them in their glory. So, but next year.
Mine looked absolutely gorgeous right now. So,
you know, they are looking gorgeous. We were just, I'll be at the Wisconsin State Fair working at We Energy's Energy Park, and I was there doing a Facebook Live kind of sneak peek, and the cone flowers are great. The bee balm is 6-8, maybe even 12 inches taller than last year. And you're right. The gardens, you know, it's kind of like when we were thinking about this, usually by now gardens are starting to wane a bit. They are looking pretty good. So, yeah, it's, sorry, Kay, I shouldn't be saying that. Oh, they're awful out there. You're not missing anything, right?
Oh, boy. And my daylilies. I've got some of the giants. They're like over 6 feet tall.
Wow.
And they're just now opening up to flower. So you know, bright yellow flowers.
I have some. Are they really fragrant also?
Yes.
Oh, mine too. Mine are behind a Hypericum, a St. John's wort, and they're blooming yellow, and they're and it's just, I'd like to say that was really my initial plan. It was an accidental combination. But, you know, I was talking to somebody about dahlias going, oh, you know, there's so many out there, but if you use them strategically or have those unique ones placed in the right, they're still, you know, great showstoppers in the garden.
They are indeed. Let's go to Tom in Merton next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry, Melinda. We've been growing basil for years and years and always had very good success. This year, for the first time ever, we have gotten some kind of black fungus on the bottom of the leaves. The leaves are small, stunted, and brown, and are sure not for lack of water.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
I'll confess, when I was doing my sneak peek at the Energy Park at Wisconsin State Fair, I pulled a few dead basils out that we lost there. So I can feel that it's kind of challenging. Downy mildew is probably one of the most common diseases on basil, and it can cause sometimes a gray and then some black leaf spot on those leaves. The cool, wet weather, especially the cooler temperatures early in the season, really predisposes those plants to some problems. The purple leaf basil tends to be more resistant. There's a new basil out, and this is for next year because we're always planning ahead, right? There's a new basil out from Proven Winners called Amazel, A-M-A-Z-E-L, Amazel basil. It grows huge. I grew it last year. I have a plant in my garden this year as well. It's a little hard to find, so I'm hoping next year it'll be a little more available for us. But it tends to be more resistant to downy mildew, and it tends to flower later too, not put out the flowers as early. Pick off the infected leaves. You know, usually we don't want to be using fungicides on things we're going to eat because the wait period often, you know, by the time you wait, new things are infected. So picking off the infected leaves, this drier weather we're having and warmer weather should hopefully help as well. So a good bit of sanitation should be helpful.
And thanks, Tom, for calling. You know, you've mentioned State Fair a couple times, and I know you're always really active at State Fair.
You bet. I'm going to be there twice a day, every day, as I have been for, I think, almost 20 years now.
Wow.
Speaking at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., and our theme is gardening for your health and well-being. So we've got a beautiful feature garden that shows lots of ornamental vegetables and some cool different tomato towers, because aren't we always looking for the best and the sturdiest tomato tower?
Mm-hmm.
We've also got great pollinator plants and some tricks for encouraging, creating that habitat to bring the pollinators in so we have good pollination so that we have, you know, lots of flowers and vegetables, fruits and flowers and vegetables in the garden. And then just answering questions as always. And so I always love State Fair because I get to meet a lot of your listeners, Larry, and others, and talk gardening in a beautiful space. Doesn't get much better.
Doesn't get much better than that. Well, 10 to 2, 10 o'clock or 2 o'clock.
Correct.
Every day.
So whenever you come, stop by and see me. And if I'm not there, you don't have time to join me for my presentation. I have goodie bags. then just walk through the garden. We have a nice thick hand to eye bribe. What can I say?
Why not?
Why not? Exactly.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, that's going to be a lot of fun. Russ in Stoughton has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, hello. I had a question about, I have a volunteer, from what I can determine from Google, a cucumber plant that grew out of compost that I make during the winter, and I used in a bucket of marigolds, and the plant looks very healthy, great big wide leaves. It sprouted probably 30 days ago, has, I would say, 20-plus nice, bright yellow little leaves, but no fruit. And I'm wondering, from what I could find online, that the fruit should have started maybe 10 days after the flowers showed up. And I'm wondering, Is it because of lack of bees in the area that I have not seen not even one bumblebee this year? And so is it a lack of pollination?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because cucumbers and squash and melons produce male and female flowers, separate flowers. And so the first flush of flowers that come out are typically male flowers. They have a stem, a straight stem with a flower. The next set of flowers that come up are male and female. And then the female flower has a little immature cucumber or squash or melon underneath, okay, right below the flower. Once you have both a male and female flowers, then you have the pollen there and the female flower to receive it for the bees to pollinate. So first, make sure you have both male and female flowers. And then secondly, if you're not seeing a lot of bee activity, then you may need to get in there with your little, you know, watercolor paintbrush and do a little pollen transfer and give the bees a helping hand. And then one of the other things when I was mentioning we've got lots of pollinators at our garden with our vegetables is bringing the pollinators into the garden is a good way to not only support them, but to get them to work in your garden for you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, make sure you have both male and female flowers. And then if you do and you're not seeing a lot of bee activity, then you may want to get out there and start transferring the pollen as well.
There you go, Russ. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Bill in Madison has something for us. Hi, Bill.
Ah, thank you. So I had a lot of annual poppies that I have in my garden, and I want to save the seed. The poppies are looking really, really, really ratty right now, and I'd like to pull them, but some of the seed heads are still unripened. Some of them are brown, and I can get the seeds out, but most of them are still kind of green or white. And I wonder, I mean, these things have almost no root system at all. Can I just pull them and let them dry and ripen on a rack or something? Or do they have to stay in the ground to ripen?
You know, you'll have greater success leaving them in the ground as long as you can. You know, because even though the leaves are dead, they may be still getting some nutrients through the roots and the stem. You know, maybe take part of them and see if they ripen for you out, you know, out of the garden. And then the ones that aren't too obnoxious to look at, leave in the ground and try it that way. I usually let things really dry up so I know that they're good and mature, but I also understand having an eyesore in the garden kind of defeats the purpose of a garden. So, yeah.
So, there you go.
You know, good luck with that. And if you do have some good luck harvesting the ones that aren't ripe, let us know how it works for you.
Yeah, would love to hear, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Helen in Little Chute, your turn now. Hi, Helen.
Hey, good morning. I had a question. Just before Easter, I bought a beautiful, beautiful hydrangea, pink, and it was in a plastic container, and I enjoyed it indoors for about 8 weeks. Then I decided to plant it in a clay pot on my patio. I used potting mix that was appropriate for flowers, and it said this potting mix would feed it for 6 months. Well, my beautiful pink hydrangea has turned green, and I just wondered why.
Well, with hydrangeas, that's often what happens, that you'll see that as they mature, the flower color changes, usually from pink to brown, but often you'll see hydrangeas go from green, especially the Annabelles, to white to green. And you'll also see that sometimes with the big leaf types, the pink or the blue. The fact you still have flowers now on your hydrangea is really impressive.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, that wasn't going to be the question, right, Larry? Do you have flowers still? So as they age, often hydrangeas will go to green before they go to brown. So it's nothing you've done wrong. Actually, you should pat yourself on the back. You still have flowers on them.
Yeah.
Typically, once they're done, put out that first flush, you don't get that. So I'm wondering if you have one of the repeat bloomers that put up a second flush of flowers as opposed to one of the big leaf they typically use with the florist that, you know, put one big show on and they're done. So as those are turning green, you may want to pop those off if it looks like you've got some buds developing for later bloom or enjoy the green color. But it's just the way that those flowers tend
that's
to
the way they
chirp.
Work. That's
yeah.
the way they work.
And then, good job. I mean, that's a long time to enjoy flowers on a hydrangea.
One of my neighbors a couple of blocks down the street has some big, large hydrangeas that I have noted this morning have gone from white to a nice green. They're actually kind of attractive.
Yeah, and limelight, which is one of the favorites, you know, starts out kind of a limey green, goes to white, and then back to green. The big Annabelle types will do that as well. The hydrangeas are looking amazing right now. Just beautiful, just gorgeous.
Helen, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Yes, sir, in Greenfield, we'll go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, good morning, Larry. Good morning, Melinda. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. Back home in Palestine, we have this perennial. It looks like the honeysuckle, but it's more fragrant. It's really good. I wonder if there is such a plant here that can tolerate, the harsh winter of Wisconsin, that you can just plant it, at an arch in the backyard or like... the entrance of the fence of the house and so forth.
Yeah, and that smells great.
Smells really good. I mean, the ones that I'm talking about,
yeah.
I had a honeysuckle in the backyard. It flowers a very short time, and it's not as fragrant.
Yeah,
I'm growing a major Wheeler honeysuckle. Not real fragrant, but really bold red flowers the hummingbirds love, and mine blooms all summer. So we don't have the fragrant part. We've just extended the bloom for you with that one. If there's two clematis that will give you some bloom, not all summer, but you may want to mix it up a bit. So, you know, putting two different vines on the same arbor.
Yeah, that's a good
idea. One is sweet summer clematis, which has smaller purple. Sweet summer love clematis, sorry, having too many words in my head. And it's a cultivar, it's a variation of the sweet autumn clematis, and it blooms a little earlier, small purple flowers. Yeah, sweet summer love clematis, sorry. It has small purple flowers, very fragrant, and it blooms, it's blooming right now. It started maybe a week or two ago. And that has nice fragrant flowers. It's not quite as vigorous and huge as sweet autumn clematis. It blooms a little later with small white flowers that are very fragrant. And so sometimes mixing two vines together, you can extend the bloom time. Make sure they're relatively equal in hardiness so that you don't end up with one smothering the other. But, you know, maybe doing this major Wheeler honeysuckle, which will bloom a long period, and then combining it with, say, sweet summer love clematis, which won't give you flowers all summer, but will really give you some nice fragrance, you know, late July through fall, might be a way to get a little bit of both, the best worlds. The Japanese honeysuckle vines here are really listed as invasive because they are spreading into our native planting areas. So we really want to look at avoid those Japanese honeysuckles that tend to be a little more fragrant but also invasive. So Major Wheeler is not. Our native honeysuckles often will repeat bloom if they get enough sunlight. But check out the Sweet Summer Love. I think you might find that's a good addition to your arbor.
There you go, Yasser. Thank you so much for calling. And we'll give Chris and Adams a chance to join in. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. I would just like to really encourage people to start digging up all of the turf in their yard and planting other things there. Number one, you're creating a lot more oxygen and green space and all that kind of stuff. But I just got done with a good portion of my front yard. And I've been sitting out here having coffee in the morning and a glass of wine in the evening, and I've got butterflies and hummingbirds and pollen, other pollinators, bees I've never seen before. But it's also a social thing. I have kids from the neighborhood and dogs from the neighborhood, and I'm getting hugs, and I'm learning who the people are that live next to me and down the street and around the block. And it's a really, really great thing to just have some communication with other people who are pointing out things and saying, what's that, what's that? Oh, this is wonderful. Look, there's a monarch. Look, there's, what kind of butterfly is that? I mean, you're just having conversation with people. And it's a wonderful thing. And you don't have to mow your lawn. You plant it thick enough, and you don't even really have to weed much. You know, it makes it kind of easier, and you're not spending gasoline money and that kind of thing. Anyway, I just wanted to make a comment about that.
Well, Chris, I'm going to jump in and join you. When I lived in the city for 26 years, we gradually killed the grass in our front yard just so the neighbors wouldn't freak out totally.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have teenagers drive by when I'd be out weeding or tending the garden going, hey, lady, like your garden. You know, and I'm thinking if a teenager's impressed, just like you said, Chris, and I would have neighbors, one neighbor would give tours of my garden. It wasn't that big, but, I'd find, she goes, I hope you don't mind. I took my aunt through or so-and-so through. And you know, you bring up a good point. And the other thing that green spaces do, there's been research that shows communities with more green spaces, community gardens, parks, plantings, the overall health cost for that community is much less than communities that don't have those green spaces.
Isn't that interesting?
It is. And part of it's isolation. Isolation is one of the biggest health threats we have. And people, just like you pointed out, Chris, people tend to, gardens bring people together. What is that? Oh, look at that butterfly. Hey, there's a ladybug eating an aphid. Kids find much more exciting. And you bring up a great point. And I'm doing a class at Mequon Nature Preserve on August 22nd, sponsored by Fresh Coast Guardians, on adding natives to your landscape. So ways that you don't have to turn it into a prairie, if that's not appropriate, but we'll give you some tips on that too. But, you know, how do you add those natives to your existing garden and landscape? Because they are the most effective for feeding pollinators. So hope folks can join me for that as well.
And what's the date on that again?
It's August 22nd. It's a Thursday night at Mequon. If you haven't been to Mequon Nature Preserve, it's a very cool place.
Yes.
It's on my website, and their staff will be on hand giving tours of their gardens, and then I'll do a presentation, and, you know, we're going to talk about also not only the good things natives do for pollinators, but keeping water where it falls so we have less sewer backups and basement floodings and all those problems, and keeps our waterway cleaner by growing natives in our landscape. So, you know, I'll be there, and I hope lots. It's free.
Yeah.
And we'll have lots of fun. So it's August 22nd at 6:30 p.m. at Mequon Nature Preserve.
Excellent. And, Chris, my whole front yard is all flowers.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, and I can sit out on my front porch and with a glass of wine or whatever in the evening, and I can get all kinds of neighbors stopping by to compliment on the garden or maybe have a glass of wine with me, and it's all good. It's all good.
It is all good. I love it. Gardens have a way of bringing us together, either complaining because something's not working or celebrating because it is.
And I've got a bird bath stuck in there too, and so it all adds, and the insects go and get a drink and the birds do too, and it's a good thing. Thanks again for calling, Chris. Appreciate it. Melinda Myers, our guest, nationally known gardening expert. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, gardening expert Melinda Myers. Take a look at her website, melindamyers.com, and Myers is spelled with a Y, M-Y-E-R-S. So if you're having trouble finding it, that's how it's spelled, melindamyers.com. Always enjoy having her with us. And every one of our phone lines is filled, so let's go back to the phones. John in Middleton, you're next. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hey, thanks for taking the call here. I've got a birch tree in our front yard. It's a large tree, and we have an area that's an oval where we're, when we bought the house, you know, there were some flowers, basically some weeds planted in there. And I'm just wondering, there's not much dirt area there. I'm just wondering if there's any perennials that would be a long blooming that don't need roots to go down very deep that we could plant in there to make it look nice.
That's great. So a couple things you may want to do, if you can expand that area and then do your planting a little bit further away from the trunk of the tree where there might be a little more soil. I have really good luck with coral bells if you're getting, especially if, you know, depending on the light, if it gets a lot of hot afternoon sun under the canopy of the birch. But coral bells, I was on a garden walk in Wauwatosa years ago, and folks made almost like a tapestry using different colored foliage colors of coral bells under their trees. It was gorgeous.
Oh.
You know, so it didn't matter about the flowers. They had flowers. They were nice. They maybe mixed in some foam flower, tiarella or hookerellas. And it was gorgeous, and it was all about the different, you know, and there's so many different coral bells out there, and they're pretty shallow-rooted. And, you know, once you get them planted, put some mulch over the soil surface to help hold the moisture in. The first few years you put any perennial under a tree, you need to make sure it gets sufficient moisture to get rooted in. Once established after a year or two, most of them will be able to tolerate normal rainfall, but it tends to be shaded and dry under a tree. So I would try coral bells or foam flower, tiarella or hookerella. The hybrid between those two work very well. They tend to, once established, tolerate that dry shade. Another one that blooms all summer and will take shade, it tends to seed around but is easy to manage, is Corydalis lutea. I don't know a common name. It's Corydalis lutea, Lutea. Yellow flowers. The leaves remind me of like bleeding heart, and it blooms from spring through fall. It does. It's gorgeous. It does kind of travel a little bit. I had it in my city garden, and I'd kind of just, it has thick stems like impatiens, so I'd just pull it where I didn't want it or transplant it if I needed it. In sun, it can kind of scorch out. In heavy shade, it won't bloom real well. But under the filtered light of a birch tree, that would be very pretty. You're going to have to watch the moisture again the first year or two. But once established, I tend to be one of those people that you need to live on your own once you're established. I'm not giving you a lot of care. And that's one that I had really good success with in dry shade. And so those would be two of my suggestions. Siberian bugloss, Brunnera, has flowers in the spring, blue forget-me-not-like flowers, but the variegated leaves of, say, Jack Frost or Alexander the Great, those tend to be bigger. Nice variegation, so that bright, you don't have flowers, but you have nice bright foliage to brighten up the shade. And then dead nettle, very vigorous, so some people are like, oh, that thing's eating my landscape. So be aware, it does like to travel. But it'll bloom in a cool spring up to 3 months, either pink, white, or mauve flowers in the spring and early summer, and then they have variegated leaves as well, and they make a nice ground cover. At Berner Botanical Gardens, under one of their oak trees, they have, I think it's pink Chablis dead nettle, Lamium, as the ground cover, and then they popped in hostas, so it's like a double layer of ground. It's beautiful. It's just, you know, you get that early spring bloom from the dead nettle, the nice foliage color and texture, and then the summer or fall bloom from the hostas. So I just love that you know, it's a double ground cover. It's a very cool way to use that space.
Excellent. John, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Jeff in Wind Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Larry. Say, I finally got around to cleaning out an area that was overgrown, and now I'm wondering if I can take some hostas that are really large and separate them and get them in the ground so they make it through the year.
Yeah, late summer is a good time to dig and divide hostas, though anybody that's grown hostas, like I dig them when I have time and divide them.
Yeah.
I won't tell you the abuse I've given some hostas in the past, but as long as you can give them good post-transplant care, you'll be. It sounds like Larry has done the same.
Yes,
as
I have. And I actually have more of it to do coming up.
Okay. So, yeah, as long as, you know, if the temperatures remain high, that's where the mulch comes in handy. Shredded leaves that, you know, may, I don't know about you, but I'm always finding leaves along the fence or someplace, or, you know, shredded bark, twice shredded bark, or evergreen needles are a great mulch to keep the soil cool and moist. Watch the watering, and they'll be fine. They're very, you know, hostas are very tough. The really expensive ones that I have to admit I've bought, not really, really expensive, but more than I normally thought I'd spend, I'm a little more careful with those just because of the investment. But hostas are tough, so you'll be fine.
There you go, Jeff. Thanks a lot for calling. Patricia in Madison has something for us. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning, Melinda and Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You were talking about daylilies before, and I have some large ones blooming right now. Blossoms are so large. I was wondering, when is the best time to divide them, after they're done blooming, now or in the spring? And should they be planted right away or left to dry a little bit, almost like an iris?
You know, daylilies have a fleshy root system, and I always laugh when I look at garden books. I always look to see what they say about transplanting daylilies, and if the author says easy to transplant, I think you've never transplanted a mature daylily. Those roots, those fleshy roots are so thick, you may need a hatchet or an axe. And a friend of mine, Jerry Nelson, always says he does maintenance for people, and he goes, I dig and divide every few years just because it's easier and quicker for him as well as easier on the plant. So daylilies are tough. Because they're blooming now, if you divide them in the spring, you'll have less chance of interfering, or you could do it in the fall once they're done flowering. But early spring, just as they're emerging, would be a great time. Dig them and replant them. You don't need to dry them out because they're not the true daylilies, not a hardy lily. Now, if you're talking a hardy lily, not a daylily. So the daylilies have long leaves like grass, mm-hmm. and hardy lilies have the short ones like an Easter lily. So if they're daylilies and they're blooming late in the season, divide them in the spring. If they're hardy lilies, you can dig them after the leaves die back in the fall and then replant them right away, just like you would your tulips. So making sure we're talking about the same plant. So daylilies, grass-like leaves, do that spring or late summer because yours are blooming now. I'd wait till spring. And for hardy lilies, as the leaves are dying and drying in the fall, dig them and replant the bulb.
There you go, Patricia. Thanks so much for calling. Jeff and Nina, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We have friends of ours that want to get married in our yard in October.
Okay.
Now, there aren't a lot of
plants.
I have mostly perennial plants in my large garden, and most of those won't be blooming. Is there anything we could plant now or put in later this summer that would be still blooming in October?
The good news for you, if you don't mind adding some annuals, and one of the things I'll do is even pot up annuals and set them in the garden so it looks like that, or on the edge of the garden so the foliage of the perennials is a nice backdrop. A lot of garden centers will soon be selling, probably the end of August, pansies, ornamental peppers, even sunflowers that should be peak for the fall months. And I'm guessing if it's an October wedding, they may be looking for those fall colors anyway.
Yeah.
And grasses are always good. So I'm thinking, and then dianthus, which is carnation, are often available, snapdragons. Things that take a cooler stock, which can be fragrant and it tolerates the cooler temperature. The other thing you often find are rudbeckias, both the biennial type, annual type, and even some of the perennials that are, you know, in a pot and still blooming in October. So if you're okay with adding annuals just for that burst of color, I think you'll be able to get them in the end of August, early September, and they'll be looking pretty good for that October mm-hmm. wedding.
And it won't the expense there won't be quite as great either, I don't think.
Yeah, and if you've got a lot of perennials and not a lot of room to add things, annuals are a good thing to pop in or put in containers and scatter them around and nobody will notice. I'll still admire the nice foliage in your garden. You know, toad lilies are a nice fall blooming, late fall blooming perennial, as are asters, hardy mums like the mammoth mum. You know, those are perennials that tend to bloom late in the season. Willow Amsonia has great fall color. It's an amber color.
Angelina sedum has beautiful foliage color. So, you know, some of that, but I don't know how much room you're going to have to really pop in some perennials and to put in something you may not want next year. Maybe annuals are a better way to go.
Yeah, I think you're right, and probably kind of easier too in
easier
a way.
Easier and more reliable. I've grown flowers, pots of flowers for people's weddings, and it's the most stressful summers I've had.
And this question has come up many times for different months of the year. And it's always a crap, it's a crapshoot because even though, if you're having a June wedding or a July wedding, if it's a cold, wet spring or if it, whatever, the weather can create so many problems.
Oh, definitely. So, Jeff, good friend that you are.
Yes.
And I did flowers for a friend's wedding, and she just said, well, we're going to go to people's gardens and pick whatever and make bouquets. And I said, I'm ordering some stuff from the florist as a backup because I do not want to be the one that you point the finger to going, well, Melinda blew it, So good luck, Jeff, and what a nice friend you are.
Yeah, you are indeed. But you're probably going to have to reach into your pants pocket and pull out that billfold and maybe spend a couple of bucks. Oh, man.
Well, and I have to tell a funny story. So I was at Rotary Garden. We were shooting some video in Janesville. Beautiful garden. Mark Dwyer does an excellent job. And check out the front entrance. They painted the allium blossoms this cool blue. So there's also paint for those faded flowers. And people poo-poo it when I say that until they have a situation like Jeff. So
there you go.
A good color.
There you go.
Paint those dried flower heads. No one will know.
Melinda Myers, nationally known garden expert, our guest on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert, TV radio host, author and columnist, and author of more than 20 gardening books. Her website, melindamyers.com. Love to have her visit with us. And if you have a question for her as we move along today, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And Melinda, we have Tammy in Cumberland with something for us next. Hi, Tammy. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good afternoon. I have a couple of questions. My first question is, our house in town, we bought it 2 years ago, and it's got beautiful flower gardens all around the house. Last year, we saw a number of plants that we didn't see this year, and I'm assuming that's because of the polar vortexes and the weather we've had this year. I'm just curious if we will see those recover at all or if we can expect to not really see those much again.
I'm one of those people, I call it testing, maybe it's procrastination, but occasionally, sometimes if the plant's dead, it's dead, but maybe it's left some seedlings behind or some seeds behind, and those seeds may sprout. I've had plants where the parent plant died, but a year or two later, I found some seedlings coming up. This year, I had a lot of things that were very late in terms of sprouting. I thought I lost a couple of Rudbeckias, and boy, just last week I found that the leaves were sprouting. And so some things were very late in emerging. Some things were totally dead. If you really like the plant, you might want to put a little stake there and then avoid cultivating. A lot of plants will reseed. And if you're a good, clean, tidy gardener, I should say if you're a clean, tidy gardener, I'm not. I think I'm a good gardener.
Mm-hmm.
So I wait, and I get a lot of those seedlings that sometimes my friends who get out there and clean up and take out everything, you accidentally take out some of those seedlings as well. So, if you've got that spot, maybe just stick a little plant peg in there, a big golf tee, just to mark the spot. If you think you'd like to wait and see if it comes back next year, there might be some seedlings nearby that will do it. And yeah. It was an interesting winter. I lost some things. I had things survive that I thought would die. You know, it's every year's
you
a mystery.
Never know.
That's right. So I wouldn't give up, Tammy. And it's good that you're letting your garden go, too, because the other thing that may be, there may be some biennials that were in that garden that this year just leaves and no flowers, and next year you'll get the flowers. You know, and those tend to reseed and almost act like perennials. So, and I just put a plea out for anybody with a beautiful garden, if you can leave a plan with the new homeowner, if you sell your house. I can't tell you how many gardeners have come to me. One woman was great. She'd visit me at different garden centers, bring 5 plants and baggies, and after 3 years she goes, "We did it all. We got them all identified." And I just think, oh, she had such beautiful specimens, and, you know, had they labeled them or, you know, helped that new homeowner, all their efforts would have been taken better care of, you know, because somebody doesn't know if it's a weed or a flower. So
that's
my personal plea. So, Tammy, patience, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for you.
And thank you so much for calling. Gail from Menominee Falls emailed her Mainite salvia looking poorly. The foliage appears to be drying up as if it were October instead of July. The plants are about 7 years old and have done well till this year. They're south-facing bed. Any thoughts?
Yeah, a couple things. I've seen some root rot on a variety of plants because of the wet spring we had. And so some roots were damaged. And then we got, all of a sudden, we got this hot weather, and we've had a dry, you know, bit of dry, few dry stretches that we kind of forget to water because we had so much rain. So you might want to check the soil moisture, make sure that, some of these rains have been kind of spotty. I've watched some of the clouds go right by to the north of me. And so I check the soil moisture, make sure, you know, that it's not going too dry. Salvia can tolerate some drought. But I'm thinking it's a combination of lots of rain early, maybe a little bit of root damage from the wet soil. And Menominee Falls has a lot of clay in their soil. Most gardens do in that area. And then the heat and the drought. So just kind of check the soil moisture, make sure it's getting sufficient, not too much, and deep, thorough waterings less frequently. So if we don't get some rain soon, you may need to give it a little drink.
Dan in Milwaukee also emailed. He says, "I was always told by my fellow gardeners that I had to dig up glad bulbs every fall. I had 120 glads in my garden last year, so this was quite an endeavor. After the extremely cold winter that we had in Milwaukee, I thought there's no way they'd survive. However, to my surprise, I have a ridiculous amount of glads coming up in my garden this year. My question, do you actually have to dig up glad bulbs every year, or what's the deal?"
Okay, so Dan, your gardening friends were not playing a joke on you. You really should, for most of us, we should dig them up. They're not reliably hardy in our area, but you're in Milwaukee, closer to the lake. When I lived in Milwaukee, too, the houses were close together, so I could get away with some things because there was this great microclimate. I had a brick garage. My neighbor had a brick house. I had a brick house. I wasn't right on the lake, so I was a ways a little bit, but it was such a microclimate that there were things that survived that shouldn't. I met somebody who lives in Bayview who said, and I believe them, that their rosemary plant is outside year-round. Now, all of the rest of us are going, no way. And, you know, and so I have had other people, Dan, tell me that they leave their glads in the ground. You know, if you really want to make sure they survive, digging them up, or at least some of them up every fall, would be a good idea. You know, they made it through last winter. That's impressive. So you probably have just the right conditions. But typically, yes, dig up your glads, your cannas, your caladiums, your calla lilies. Those things really aren't reliably hardy, and reliably is the key word there. So good for you, Dan. You know,
yeah,
you took a chance and it paid off. And if you continue to do it, we're all going to be very jealous as we're digging our glass out of the ground.
And if a few die, you can just, if they are mostly living, you can always just replace as you kind of go along. Why not?
Exactly. You know, death in the garden, you know, is a sad thing. But, you know, for annuals and bulbs and perennials, it's a chance to plant something new. You know, that's the optimism side of the garden, optimistic side.
There you go. Dale in Johnson Creek, your turn now. Hi, Dale.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Yeah. the winter wreaked havoc on my boxwood, and I think a lot of people had the same problem. But I just wanted to let everybody know that it's coming back in small green leaves, and I was wondering what you can do to make it survive the next winter.
Well, let's hope we don't have as bad a one. And thank you for, you know, and that was one of the things I was telling people. Typically what happens with our broadleaf evergreens like boxwood is they lose their older leaves, but they produce the new ones, so we don't notice that. And when they brown out, as long as the branches are pliable, you're right. See, this is where patience, we'll call patience, paid off for Dale and others. You know, you get that growth off of those leaves. Don't really just, if this is a continual problem, you may want to do some burlap or row cover around the edges to cut the wind, a decorative fence. If this was just this year and they've done fine beforehand, you know, the previous years, it was probably just the extremely cold temperatures, because I had a lot of people that have had boxwoods for years, never had a problem. This cold winter really took its toll on a lot of plants, including boxwood. So if you're a little nervous about it, just putting burlap, you know, like a wind barrier to provide a little shade and protect it from winter winds, that's really all you need to do. Mulch the soil, make sure it's well watered if we have a dry fall before it goes into winter. But thank you for the report, Dale, because that gives a lot of people hope as well.
Thanks for calling. Diane in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Diane.
Yes, hi. Larry, your program is always wonderful. Well, today's program is a real treasure. I mean,
thank you.
Is it Melinda?
Yes.
Yeah, Melinda, yeah.
Oh, boy, you are a master gardener. Well, I'll tell you why I'm calling. It's kind of a 25 years ago, it's been a long time, and I used to have a quarter-acre garden, and it was organic, and I had put some egg cases in for walking sticks. I happen to really love walking sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably, I don't know how long, a year or two after that, I'm taking the groceries in to the house. We had a Cape Cod, and then in the front there's a red brick walkway with evergreens and plate-sized dahlias, and right by the front door is this walking stick. You can tell I'm impressed, because that was 25 years ago and I'm still thinking about it. But this walking stick was wrestling a little baby gardener snake, and it must have been the walking stick about 7 or 8 inches long.
Oh, my goodness.
Have you ever heard of a walking stick that's that large? Or was I like a fishing story? It grew.
That's a pretty big walking stick, Diane. I don't think I've ever seen one that big, but
I know I have it. I think I had one in my car. I was taking pots to a workshop, and on my dashboard, I must have had a walking stick on one of them. He traveled there and back with me. But it was only about 4 inches, I think, is the biggest I've ever seen. Larry, and it sounds like you haven't seen an 8-inch one either.
No.
So you, two things. You probably have the right conditions. This sounds like a question for PJ or Phil, our entomologist, UW Extension entomologist, to see if that's a record. Or, you know, I used to laugh. I was in the city of Milwaukee, and I said my voles were much smaller. Now I'm in the country more, and I'm like, the voles here are a lot bigger. So, you know, rural life has been good for them. So I don't know if you just have the right environment, plenty of food, and or maybe those egg cases had some gigantic species of walking stick. That's very cool.
Yeah, very cool. Diane, thanks for calling. I'm going to ask PJ.
Yeah, please do, because I'd be curious to, you know, he may say, oh, of course, they get that big in this part of the state or whatever, or if he's impressed like us, we know we haven't missed anything. We'll have to go visit Diane.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks again for calling, Diane. Well, Jeffrey emailed and says, all my hydrangeas are looking good this year, except for endless summer. The foliage is healthy. I don't add fertilizer, but I got no bloom. I call them endless bummer.
Yes, and I've also heard them called endless disappointment, too.
Yes.
So, yes. Jeffrey, here's the deal. The repeat blooming, these are a big leaf hydrangea, and originally big leaf hydrangeas only bloom on old growth. Our winters are so hard, they die back to the ground, beautiful leaves, no flowers. endless summer, and there's quite a few other new introductions, are repeat bloomers. So if they die back to the ground and they put out new growth, they're supposed to flower on that new growth. As the nicknames tell you, they don't always do it reliably. And here's some things I found that help boost flowering. Moisture makes sure, not a problem this year, that spring through summer they receive sufficient moisture. The other thing is one fertilizer application in the spring. And here's why I recommend Milorganite, not just because I work with them, but because Milorganite does contain non-leaching phosphorus. That helps promote bloom, and it doesn't leach through the soil. It's 85% organic matter, so it's feeding the soil. But research found when the microorganisms work on releasing the nutrients from the Milorganite, it releases some of the phosphorus, good for flowering, and potassium, good for disease resistance and hardiness, and makes it available to the plant. And almost everybody, I've only had a few people complain, that when they do that once in the spring, just one application in the spring, that's enough to get it to flower. Now, it's never going to look like the ones in Tennessee and Georgia because we just are too far north. But at least you'll get some blossoms on them as well. All that jazz, some people have told me they've had better luck. Some of the, you know, the repeat bloomers, you just kind of have to plant them and just realize they're the best we can do for here. And maybe go with some of the panicle hydrangeas like Pinky Winky that has light and dark pink flowers, Bobo, which has all white, but they're shorter. You know, that might be a way to get some color but more reliability. Invincible Spirit 2 has pink flowers on an Annabelle-type hydrangea. Ruby Spirit has a little deeper pink with a silvery edge on the petals. So there's some improvement happening there, and those are reliable, hardy to zone 3, flower on new growth, so you'll get pink flowers, not quite the same, but still the beauty of a hydrangea. So those are a little more reliable, and I think you'll get greater pleasure out of them.
There you go. Terry sent us an email and says, many of my annual Victoria Blue Salvia plants are looking stunted. The leaves are very thin, almost like an echinacea with aster yellows. I know Blue Salvia is a workhorse of a plant. Is this some new trouble?
You know, again, I would check this, you know, if you can sacrifice one, Terry, and dig it up and see if there's some problem happening with the roots. Sometimes insect feeding, but if this is the Terry I think it is maybe calling, she's a very good plants person, and I love Victoria Salvia as well. Sometimes when there's aphid or mite damage, and even though it's rained, I've had some reports of some aphid, some, you know, populations of aphids kind of out of control. Sometimes their feeding can stunt as well as plant bugs, so maybe looking a little closer for some insect damage and check the roots. Those would be the things that I would check for. I don't think, and then has anybody sprayed a pesticide and herbicide in the area?
Yeah.
Even if you haven't, that drift, we've had some pretty good winds lately, and even with high temperatures, when temperatures get in the 90s, if someone's spraying some of the broadleaf weed killers, bad for your lawn anyway. When the temperatures are hot and in the summer, sometimes you can get some volatilization of those chemicals that can cause damage too, that can cause that thin, just like a dandelion looks when it's sprayed with 2,4-D.
Yeah. Rick in Grafton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I grow my own dill for various pickling items, and for whatever reason this year, something is attacking my dill. I have various plantings and full-grown, only knee-high plants, whatever. Something is biting them off at or around ground level, and they just leave them lay. I'm wondering what on earth might be doing. I've never had a problem. I have 6-foot-high fence around it that I just put in a week ago, and it still continues. And even plants that are 3/4 of an inch thick, it's like someone took a machete and cut them. Any ideas?
You know, usually when I think of cutworms, I think of gardens typically are more of a problem in new gardens that are converted from lawn. Cutworms do it kind of that damage that you're recommending. It almost looks like the neighborhood kids took a machete or scissors and cut the plant off. You know, just putting something as simple as a can around, you know, take the top and bottom off a soup can or a tuna fish can and sink it in the ground an inch below, an inch above, that's enough to stop the cutworms. rabbits have very sharp teeth. You want to make sure that they're not scurrying under your fence, or if you have a gate, getting through that gate, because they can slide in. Ground squirrels, you know, they might be eating it and going, ew, don't like the taste, and that's why they're leaving it lay. But typically that sounds very much like a cutworm problem.
It does. You know, well, rabbits make that nice sharp cut, too, though.
Someday. They do, like scissors. And they may be taking a bite and not learning their lesson, going, I don't like the flavor, and eating another one. And, you know, with the fence, it makes you feel better. I have a deer fence around my garden, and we hadn't had problems with rabbits, and one got in, and it was because the gates weren't secure. My fault. I know better. But, you know, usually the hawks took them out before they got to that garden, And so I've been feeding it rabbits, and I've had fencing within my fencing to try to protect some plants. And they're pretty sly critters, as are the ground squirrels. But rabbits, Larry's right, sharp teeth like scissors. So you may want to make sure they can't access that, and then also try the cutworm collars as well.
Carol wondered about, she's harvesting garlic onions and Walla Walla onions, and wondered about harvesting, curing, and storing onions, scallions, and garlic. Do you do it all the same way, or do you set in the sun or the shade?
Yeah, thank you, Carol. It's a good reminder because I've been looking at my garlic going, I got to harvest that pretty quick. So for a lot of us, it's that time to do it. Basically, you could leave your onions. A lot of people dig the onions and leave them out in the field. I always worry about, or in the garden, I always worry about animals getting to them. Bring them into a warm, dry location, setting them on screen so you've got good airflow will work for both onions that you're drying and saving as well as garlic. And then, so that's where a warm, dry location. I prefer out of the garden. You'll see some documents that say dig them and leave them lay in the garden, and you can. I have a lot of ground squirrels that like to eat everything. So that's why I usually bring them into maybe my garage where it's warm and dry, set them on screens. I can open the garage door and kind of monitor for animals that might sneak in to eat. But give them about a good week to be nice and dry. And then you can just store them in a cool, dark place.
There you go. And State Fair, just mention, talk again for a minute about, you're going to be there the whole time.
Yes, I am. It's a great gig. I'm there every day of the State Fair, all 11 days, speaking at 10 and at 2, gardening for your health and well-being, and, of course, answering questions until they kick me off stage or everybody leaves. We've got beautiful gardens. We've got lots of natives mixed in with cultivated plants. We've got recycled items used as planters. We've got nice vegetables. I call them my tetanus tomato towers. It's made from reinforcement wire. And, you know, you buy concrete reinforcement wire, it's always rusty. So when I made these for a video, I went and got my tetanus shot updated. So I thought, this is not working well. A cool new one from Gardener Supply, looks very space age, called Vertex, that I just put around my tomato 2 days ago. And it was easy. You know, they were pretty big, but I could easily do it by myself and not damage the plant. Good for those procrastinators like me, very sturdy and tall. So we've got lots of new techniques that we can show you and share. We've got goodie bags to help you in the garden. I have some prizes, too. So like I said, I'm not above bribing you to come visit with me. And it's a beautiful space to sit and relax. And then We Energies also has fun things for the family and kids. Schutz Audubon does a Birds of Prey show. Peter and Robert do fun energy shows. Chef Mark does good cooking tips that even excite me. So come join me. We'll have a lot of fun.
Thanks, Melinda. Really appreciate it. Appreciate it very much. Melinda Meyer, she'll be at State Fair 10 or 2 every day. She'll be talking. Oh, great to have her with us. She'll be back. We'll do it again Monday. We'll talk about greatest moments in human space flight and how to make the most out of your retirement as well. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.